Okay. This is the Community Corrections Partnership meeting set for October 23rd, 2013 for 8:30 a.m. We will convene this meeting, and Ms. Jameson, will you please call the roll?
Chief Cudet?
Here.
Court Executive Officer McNally? District Attorney Green?
Present.
Public Defender Moore?
Here.
Sheriff Youngblood?
Here.
Dr. Waterman?
Here.
Chief Williamson?
Here.
Director Alvarez?
Here.
Director Cheadle?
Pam Holloway, Chair of the
Executive Director Corson?
Here.
Supervisor Perez?
Here.
Director Smith?
Here.
Superintendent Lazardi Frazier? And Division Director Miracle?
Here.
Okay.
Right now, this is the time for public comment, and I would ask you to keep it 2 minutes. That's why we have a sheet clock over here by the window. But also, I've kind of been loose on this, but once you're done at the podium, unless anybody from the commission or committee asks you the right question, please do not have any more comments. That was going to be whatever you say at the podium will be. So, is there anybody in the public that would like to make a statement? That's not related to anything on the agenda. Because you'll have this opportunity to talk about the agenda. So, is there any item that's not related to the agenda? Okay, thank you. I see none. Okay, first on our agenda, we have Jenny Montoya-Tandy from the California for Safety and Justice, and she's going to make a presentation for us.
Good morning. So, my name is Jenny Montoya-Tandy. I'm the Research and Information Director at California for Safety and Justice. And I'm without my PowerPoint this morning, so you'll have to bear with me as I wing this a little bit. But I believe I met some of you at some regional convenings that we've been having around the state, around the Affordable Care Act. I'm glad to be in Kern County today. California for Safety and Justice is statewide. Oh, there's some funny people.
Yeah,
it's
longer than
mine. I thought that was good. Yeah, I'm beatboxing. I have the lower going on.
Do we have anybody with technical knowledge?
You know what? I could also just project. Maybe you've done all
okay.
Okay. So, as I was saying, California for Safety and Justice is a statewide nonprofit organization that was founded. We're actually about as old as Realignment, and that's not a coincidence. A group of philanthropic foundations got together around the time that Realignment was coming into being because they saw that there were going to be some challenges and some new opportunities present with the transition of responsibility to local county justice systems, and felt that some investment in supporting local innovation would be helpful. So our organization was formed. The California Endowment is actually a major funder of ours, and they've also made some additional investments with California for Safety and Justice to support our work trying to help counties leverage the Affordable Care Act with respect to their criminal justice populations. And as I understand it, Kern County is also a grant recipient of the California Endowment, specifically focused on medical enrollment for hard-to-reach populations, including your reentry and homeless populations. So I actually think there's a lot of great synergy for California for Safety and Justice to be able to support what I think is really exciting work that you're doing in Bakersfield and Kern County to connect people in the criminal justice system to quality treatment in the community and get them enrolled in health insurance. So happy to be here today. I think when I spoke with Becky, she wanted me to just kind of outline what I see as some of the primary opportunities for your justice system with respect to the changes that are happening in the public health system in California under the Affordable Care Act. So I'll just briefly highlight what I think are the three most important pieces of that. First, we've got expanded eligibility, which I'm sure many of you are well aware of. Two, we've got some enhanced benefits for mental health and substance use disorders. under the Medi-Cal Convention, and three, we've got some new funding schemes, new federal dollars that are available both to pay for healthcare and then also to pay for enrollment and support for the Medi-Cal program. So, as I'm sure you know, Medi-Cal has expanded to cover adult citizens and many non-citizens as well who are whose incomes fall under 130% of the poverty line. That's a big shift. Historically, you have to fall into certain demographic categories, like being blind or pregnant, in order to qualify for Medi-Cal. That's no longer the case. And as I'm sure many of you are aware, there's a huge overlap between county justice populations and the population that's newly eligible for Medi-Cal. So it's not only a great opportunity to connect people in the justice system to treatment, it also means that any effort to do broad-based Medi-Cal enrollment in a county won't be successful unless there's real focus on the justice system, and I think that's why it's wonderful that Clinton County has received this grant to specifically focus on that area. Covered California is also providing financial assistance to purchase private health plans, which can help certain probationers, for example, who might be employed or have a family member in their household who's employed, whose incomes are a little bit higher than 138% of the poverty line. Covered California plans also cover pretrial inmates for people who are in jail who are serving a sentence. They could be dropped from their covered California plan. So that's it, expanded eligibility. It's really an extremely historic shift for a population that's been maybe 75 to 90% uninsured over the years to now be able to access health insurance and come into the health system as a real, you know, legitimate number for the first time. Enhanced benefits, maybe some of you have been tracking this story as well, but California, well, first of all, under the Affordable Care Act, all health plans, including private insurance that's offered on the health care exchange covered California and Medi-Cal, have to cover mental health and substance abuse. That's a shift from some, you know, previously didn't cover mental health and substance abuse. I think a bigger shift with respect to the criminal justice population is that Drug Medi-Cal is going to be offering enhanced benefits to the full population. So previously, full services under Drug Medi-Cal were really only available to pregnant and postpartum women. Now, things like intensive outpatient, some residential rehabilitation, and elective detox are going to be available to everyone who's on the Medi-Cal rolls, including people in the justice system. One thing to keep in mind that's important in terms of coverage is that while someone is an inmate in an institution, their health care costs are not covered by Medi-Cal. But somebody who's a probationer, somebody who's on home detention or electronic monitoring, somebody who's part of a reentry population coming out of jail or prison, all of those people could be eligible to access those services. And when I was talking with Becky, I think one of the big issues in Kern County and something that's really going to be an issue across the state is whether there's adequate treatment capacity to meet the new need and the new population that's going to be covered, and I think it's going to be really exciting to see what strategies can be developed. This enhanced drug medical benefit is actually a chance for California counties, and I think the reason it's structured this way was to give California counties a chance to sort of bulk up their treatment capacity, and so, you know, we don't have a lot of time today, but I think that's an interesting conversation that we could have. So enhanced, particularly drug treatment and mental health benefits, that's the second big change. And then the third is new federal funds. I think many of you may be aware that for the first 3 years of the Medi-Cal expansion, the new population will be covered 100% by the federal government. That's going to step down to 90% by 2020. And from 2020 forward, 90% of those costs will be picked up by the federal government, and the remaining 10% of the non-federal share will be the state. So it's a big difference between the historic Medi-Cal population, which was a 50-50 split, and this population was covered by the federal government at a much higher rate. So there's what I think there's a really strong incentive to get people on the rolls from a fiscal perspective. There's also some money available to pay for enrollment and support for the Medi-Cal program. that I believe Kern County is well aware of two programs. One, through Covered California, there's a program to certify enrollment entities and counselors. It's a paid for successful application. And there's going to be some additional money available through the California Endowment to pay for successful Medi-Cal applications, $58 per application. So I think you guys are already really actively engaged in that process, but if you want more information, I'm happy to provide it. And then second, the MA, the County MA program, Medi-Cal Administrative Activities. This is something that all counties in California have been claiming. It's a federal government program that provides financial participation from the federal government for not only application assistance and enrollment, but also targeted case management, transportation, a lot of services that support access to health care for people who are enrolled in Medi-Cal. And I think the difference here is that historically it's been used in every California county, but I think it's been underutilized in the justice system. And that's because many people in the justice system were not eligible for Medi-Cal. But for probation departments, for example, I think it's a big opportunity now, particularly in the realignment era where a lot of probation departments are providing case management services for some of their caseloads, really playing an active role in connecting them to services in the community. That may be a way to help AB-109 stretch farther because you can claim 50% of those activities and be reimbursed by the federal government. There's a lot of administrative burden associated with the program. It's not an easy program necessarily to get up and running, but I think it's something that might be interesting to support. So that's basically it. People in the justice system can get health insurance now. There are better benefits available, and there's money to move people into the program and support them. That's what I was here to share with you today, and I'm happy to continue the conversation after I'm based in Oakland, but I'm down in Southern California all the time. So we're just really happy to see what's going on in Kern County, and I'm very interested to learn more about what you've been able to accomplish.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Thank you for being here. Thanks for the information. What is the process of enrollment for incarcerated folks?
Thanks for asking. That's a great question. So I'll just start by saying overall there's been some streamlining and adjustments to the enrollment process from what we're seeing in Medi-Cal. One big change is that as part of Covered California's online portal, it's now going to be possible to apply for Medi-Cal online through the state. And I think that's actually important for justice populations because it provides an opportunity to, say, collect some information from people when they're booked into jail or at another stage in the justice process, you know, hold that information and then enter it in electronically. You know, you could have someone pop that in, hold it, and then press submit, you know, the day they're released and get them on very quickly. It cuts down on the time to process an application because it's being processed by an algorithm rather than a human making an eligibility determination. I don't know if anybody's tried to go online. There's definitely, much like healthcare.gov, there are some issues with coveredcalifornia.com right now, but I think they're getting smooth. I've noticed some improvements over the last couple months, and if you go on, or the last couple weeks, if you go on now, you can get a real-time eligibility determination for Medi-Cal, which is pretty cool. It used to take several weeks to figure that out. So I think that's great for justice populations that they could get a real-time eligibility determination. And then the other piece is that the need for paper documentation to support a Medi-Cal application is reduced under the online application. Not to say no one will have to provide supportive documentation, but the online application is linked to a number of federal databases that can verify. So if you have something like a social security number that you can put in, it'll check Social Security Administration, the IRS database, et cetera. And for some people in the justice system, as well as many people in the community, there won't be a need for, say, you know, turning in also some income verification paperwork that might be hard for people to pull together if they're right out of jail. So, like I said, I don't think that will be true for everyone. Certainly, many people, there'll be some follow-up because their information doesn't check out. But for some people, that'll be really helpful.
So no enrollment while they're incarcerated?
Well, there's actually been some legislation that passed that my organization was sponsoring that's going to be important for that piece. So AB 720 basically extended a policy that's been in place for juveniles since 2010 to say that, so previously if you're an adult, you go into jail and you have Medi-Cal, your benefits were terminated. Today, or starting in January, they'll be placed in suspended status while you're incarcerated, and they'll be reactivated the day that you're released. The other thing that 720 said is that the fact that somebody is incarcerated doesn't preclude a social service agency from processing their application. So if they meet other eligibility requirements, they should be able to apply and enroll while they're incarcerated. Now, I think that's where it would make sense for social services and the sheriff or whoever is promoting enrollment in the jail to sit down and figure out, okay, from a workload standpoint, when does it make the most sense? And from other standpoints as well, in terms of efficiency and making sure the most people come on the rolls, when during a stay would it make sense to enroll someone? But people should be able to enroll throughout their stay. And one thing to mention on that is that Medicaid administrative activities can fund enrollment in the 30 days prior to release. So you can make a 50% claim on any cost of application assistance for inmates in the 30 days prior to their release from jail. So for pre-trial, a lot of that will be, you know, within the same month for sentenced inmates, it might be later in their stay.
Okay.
Yeah.
At this time, counties do not have a mandate to require our local sheriff to enroll people.
No, there's no mandate. I think there's just strong financial incentive to do so.
And we have been doing this in the juvenile population for a little while, and it does cut down the time that we can get them back on Medi-Cal once they're released from the facility. So before, we had to just start the process all over again once they got out. Now there is suspension of the hours there when they get out. It's a quicker process to get them back. The public center one.
You spoke about the importance of a partnership between the criminal justice and healthcare system. And so my question involves working or steps that can be taken to increase revenues coming into the county. You indicated reimbursements are available for probationers but not inmates. So that would suggest that we're appropriate to channel folks into probation versus incarceration. You also shared that to the extent that resources might be available, the time might be exceeded by virtue of processing applications while folks are still in custody, even though they are not eligible for reimbursement for the county bills. Apart from those two practical steps, what is the takeaway in terms of increasing revenue for the county?
There's a lot of potential areas for increasing revenue. So one, many of you may be aware, there's an exception to the fact that generally speaking, inmate healthcare costs are not covered, which is inpatient care. So if there's an inmate that goes off the grounds of the jail to receive inpatient care in a county hospital or some other non-correctional healthcare facility, those costs can be covered by Medi-Cal. That's not very common occurrence, but when it happens, it can get really expensive, so that can definitely be helpful. I think this isn't necessarily revenue generating, but I think it's an important cost savings. Many jails put significant resources in stabilizing the conditions of individuals that come into their jail while they're there. That may be the only place they are able to access health care typically, or where they don't have to choose to access health care. I think post-release, if people are connected to Medi-Cal, it really increases the county's ability to preserve that investment. If people don't have health care when they get out of jail, they're very likely to seek care in the emergency room within the first 30 days of their release. And if they're connected and they know, okay, here's where I go for my provider, here's where I go to get my prescription filled and continue on their medication, I think you're likely to see reduced the emergency room. So that's a cost saving. Other places where, I think you've identified a really key area for revenue generation and cost savings, which is that for certain individuals, it could be somebody who could really benefit from, you know, supervision and treatment, and previously there wasn't enough money to pay for that treatment. So, you know, that's certainly an opportunity that could somewhat, you know, reduce certain jail pressures. And I think a lot of counties are seeing this as a really exciting opportunity to make their pretrial services program more robust, get some people out and place in a treatment that hopefully could, you know, make them successful, and then even reduce their length of stay post-trial. I think that's actually one of the major cost-saving areas. And then I think overall, of course, the whole idea here is that connecting people to care and getting them really, you know, into the system is going to reduce healthcare costs. And there have been some studies that have demonstrated that in Washington State, they extended Medi-Cal a little bit earlier than we, and then we did in a pilot program, and were able to study for seriously mentally ill people who are enrolled in Medi-Cal. That actually not only reduced justice system costs, but it bent the cost curve for their healthcare costs. Their healthcare costs slowed the rate of growth significantly just by being enrolled in the healthcare plan.
You mentioned also, and fully, that's quite an answer to the question, but technically they're not released from custody. They use alternatives. The Sheriff's Department uses alternatives in custody because it's like electronic monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
With, even though they're technically in custody, but they're out,
yes.
Are they eligible?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Anybody who's residing in the community, regardless of if they're in the Sheriff's custody or not, could be covered.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
What you're telling is that what you're saying is right. The difficult population are those that have conditions that are not particularly, don't particularly want treatment necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So would you say that the key there is probably insurance, yes, but also setting up some sort of holding environment around those people, such as a sheriff's parole and early release, or having a probation tail. As opposed, that's not an issue all around California, that counties have gone to actually not having a tail on the not having a probation status, so people disappear again.
Yes, I think that definitely many people have noted that people can make a transition better out of custody with the tail. But I think your general point is great. I think that. For people who are in the justice system who, you know, wouldn't be suitable for an OR or something like that, certainly placing some conditions to attend treatment from either the sheriff or from probation could be very effective in ensuring their participation. Yeah, definitely.
I guess my point was that the medical insurance is only half the picture.
Oh, yeah.
Actually getting people to care.
That's right. That's right.
The incentives around that is really just as important.
Yes. Enrollment is not the end of the story by any means. That's the very first step to building an effective program and connecting people and getting them to stay in treatment. Absolutely.
Okay, any other questions for the commission? Any public? Anybody in the public would like to have questions or like to talk about? I see none. Thank you very much for joining us. It was very informative. I think there's a lot of opportunity here, and I think it definitely could benefit our county.
Well, it seems that Kern County is already ahead of the curve in terms of really strong efforts to enroll your hard-to-reach population, including the population. So I definitely applaud that and really look forward to hearing what's wrong.
Okay, item number two is the minutes from our CCC meeting on June 19, 2013. This is the time for approval for that. Are there any questions, corrections, amendments to the minutes from that meeting from the commission? If you have any comments or questions from the public on the minutes? I see none. Then I will need a motion in a second to approve the minutes from that date.
A motion.
Motion by Dr. Waterman, seconded by Supervisor Perez. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Any objections? The objections from the okay, item three, I'm sorry, I took this out of, I didn't follow the agenda exactly, so But I will ask again if there's anybody in the public who would like to speak on something that is not related to any of your items. Okay, I've seen that. Item number four is the chairperson's report. This will be very brief. Basically, as you know, in the 13-14 fiscal year, the entire allocation was $998 million, where we received 2.78% of that, whereas in the first year we received 3.06%. So our percentage went down, unfortunately. We do have the growth money, which we will talk about. However, there is no permanent formula. The formula that they, I believe, the CTAC responsibility to come up with a formula with a three-year plan. So starting in the fiscal year 14-15, they will decide, I understand, a permanent formula for any future funding. And they are also estimating at this point that the entire pot will go down from $998 million to $934.1 million. So a higher percentage would be beneficial if we can get that, manage that. What that means also is the percentage stays the same, that we would lose $1.8 million to work with for this county alone. So anyway, it's going to be important for us to have a strong voice to show that we are making progress, I think. The growth money, again, we will discuss later. So there was a 10.34%, which Kurt received from that growth money. But I'm going to save any of the comments for that agenda item to come up. Okay. There is no action required on that report. Any members of the committee who would like to make an announcement or report? Yes, Dr. Walker.
Can I just follow up on your comment there? I mean, it seems to me like the decision will essentially be made by who ends up in the process to make the decision. And so we need to not wait around and then complain. But I know there's no answer, but I guess I just want to say someone needs to be really working on the behind the scenes on who gets on that committee, who influences the process, from the way it's set up. That's really where the decision is going to be made. So I doesn't need an answer, but I just don't want to be in the position of the county again of just saying, oh, we didn't get our fair share, when that's not going to help, really.
But I do believe, and I'll leave this, I think the Mr. Norman will answer, but I do believe we are working real hard to do that.
Yeah, Jim, the committee from the CAOs is called the RAC Committee, the Realignment Allocation Committee. The members are set on that. We have a couple members from the Central Valley who are going to be strong. We have had and continue to have a very strong voice in the process, I think. The County of Kern has the second largest allocation percentage of growth money because of that. There'll be a meeting next month with regard to the RAC committee in Sacramento. We'll be present, we will have a voice, and we will continue to push hard for the type of allocation model that benefits communities where there are a lot of inmates, I don't want to call inmates, but there are a lot of the people we serve instead of just general population or some other variable that doesn't seem to make sense. So we fought hard before, we'll continue to fight.
Yes, public defender.
I would just like to share that after the public defender's office for the 3 months ended September 30th, we, as a new fiscal year, we experienced an increase in caseload of more than 20% on a year-over-year basis and more than 40% for the prior year. That, I think, is fairly attributable to the effects of realignment, since that is the identifiable area. I imagine and expect other partners in the criminal justice system experience similar pressures and increased workload. bring it up at this point as it relates to potentially working to strategize or develop an approach to bring before the board supervisors to promote the prospect of increased funding for public space communication. I'm interested, of course, in ensuring that we're able to adequately staff the cases under extreme caseload pressures. So I just bring it up because I think this is perhaps a body of shared interest in that.
Thank you. Any comments from the committee on this? Okay, then any other comments or reports from this commission? And I see then we will move on to number six, the fourth quarter financial summary report.
Good morning, everyone. You should have a copy in your packet of our fourth quarter fiscal year 12-13 data tracker and also financial summary report. Unless individual members want to discuss theirs, we don't have anything on there that is a stock value or anything like that to point out, other than everybody is progressing and seems to be still kicking into high gear. We're still coming off of increase in financial, increase in realignment dollars from last year. So with that, I leave it to the committee. I want to thank the individuals who helped put together this report, and also very quickly, I want to introduce that we have a new person working in our department, a new analyst who's helping. Her name is Cassandra Krieger.
Good morning.
And she started in August, and she's also going to be assisting with not only these reports, but we have some other things going on, some big projects. That I think will be very beneficial for our county as well. So just like Andrew said, if any individual members comment on theirs, I leave it to the committee for receiving
five. Are there any committee comments that anybody would like to report out on the documents that you're providing?
Make a motion to receive and file.
I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Next is fiscal year 12-13 fourth quarter team tracker report.
It's same report, basically, working with on the financial side, this kind of on the data and information. We're going to be adding this year, fiscal year, we'll be adding the public defender, and we'll be meeting with them actually very soon. He's already got a lot of information for us. And you, at the next meeting, will see the first quarter, fiscal year 13-14 financial reports and data.
Okay, any questions or comments regarding the key data tracker? Any comments from the public on it? All right, I need a motion or a second to receive and file this information.
Second.
Supervisor Perez made the motion.
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Court. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Any objections? I just want to note that Senator Green did not vote on that. Okay, number eight, the Board of State Community Corrections, which constantly changes their title, but the CCP survey report for 81 or 9 implementation and funds of $200,000.
Thank you, Chair Christian. What you have before you is a survey report from the Board of State and Community Corrections. And I'll go into some kind of background on it. But basically, in order for us to receive our $200,000 in planning and implementation funds this year, they're requiring that we actually do a survey. For the past two prior years, they've just kind of checked. Different now. In order to receive the money for this year, they wanted to complete a 16-page survey, and they will cut the check in January. What's interesting about this is that they have, like I mentioned, have not requested in the past. They're also strongly, it's not required, strongly recommending CCP input, and that's why it's placed on the agenda for your perusal today. This survey is very foretelling for us. It's very interesting in that the survey is not asking what are we doing in our plan. The survey is asking, are you doing certain things in your plan? They don't even give you an option to provide additional information. And so, for example, the outcomes, achievements, programs, successes, those kinds of things. And on, for example, on page 3 is a good example of that, where they list all of the items that are very specific, such as community service programs, counseling programs, the DRC, educational programs, whether or not our county is providing those things or not. There's nothing in there about other things you can comment, but you can't necessarily go on and on about, you know, other items. So my point being is this is probably not the first time they're going to ask for information such as this to receive funding. And what is very interesting about this is just by virtue of what they're asking for, it's a pretty good indication of what they probably feel the money should be spent on. So it's just a side note on that, but I think it's extremely important. So basically the report is set up that they want to know each year in our plan have we addressed certain issues, certain things. So we've indicated that the draft you have before you are information that our department put in there. We have also some additional things on success stories. We put in there, for example, like with our CEOs, our DRC, things of that nature, in terms of successful collaborations, all those types of things. So I think it's really important in that respect so that they can see where the money is going and that we are making a strong effort to put it into evidence-based programs. So hopefully everybody had a chance to review that was sent out with the agenda. If anybody has anything they would like to add or change, I'd like to leave that open.
Are you done with the report?
Yes.
Now it's time for any comments, questions, and statements regarding the report. Yes, Director.
Chief Cougay, can we have a sidebar regarding drug court? And the only reason that I mention that is that we do have an interagency MOU with your department to support our some staff.
This is specifically asking just about the 109 plan. So although we have a drug court in the county, it's not specifically related to 109.
Thanks for the clarification.
Any other topics for the board?
Okay, this is as it relates to Ms. Jamison, I think very insightful observation that they're seeking materials to respond to on that is important. So I guess on page 8, there is a answer given to CCTV results from outcome measures in fiscal year 2011 and 2012 and 2014 to the different local decision making cycles. And the answer is no. And also in the number 5, but let's start with number 7. So I'm wondering whether or not we might consider the question in a fashion which might allow us to get to a yes. And it seems to me that the CCP general growth executive team really did carefully consider those responses and data that was presented in connection with formulating the budget allocations and decisions that have been made. So I think that we may be throwing ourselves a little bit short and not claiming credit for that, as well as maybe revisiting the answer number five.
Okay, I'm going to maybe pass this over to David to answer that, but I'm not sure we have all the data from that year at the time we decided this funding. But Jameson?
We took it from the approach, or at least I did, in terms of answering that question, a couple of things. One is the VSCC contacted us a number of months ago regarding our plan. They actually called us on the phone, the same individual that's listed on this report. And he asked, are there outcome measures? And he said, are they specifically identified outcome performance measures? And we had to say no, the way he was defining it. However, I said that we do within individual departments, the ACP spends a tremendous amount of time on specifically addressing issues based on needs, gaps, talked about our, you know, our ad hoc committee process, how we went through that, those types of things. The way he explained it is the reason, and I'm not against putting it, believe me, but the way he explained it to us, we didn't have something that was written that said outcome measures, and here they are, and where are you with those, and specifically how have you achieved them? So, in the plan itself. So that was the question, but we can certainly ask.
May I just follow up?
Sure.
So, I mean, as like a lawyer from a lawyer perspective, I'm pretty sure here's what it is. Well, where, sir, when you want to define it in terms of outcome measures, just because we haven't self-styled something under that particular term because we haven't received it before, I don't think the practice has the ability to say, when the sheriff, for example, has provided wonderful information about there on their data truck and their dashboard that I think very well tracks outcome. And so just because in a conversation, an individual shared with you this, unless there's something that you can point to, I go back to it, and you know, health has done well, probation has done well, that we've all been working hard to look at our outcomes.
And about one.
I reported to the Board of Supervisors 2 weeks ago about specific numbers of how many people were enrolled in drug treatment in the jail, how many completed that phase, how many transitioned to our outpatient phase, how many people successfully completed that, the frequency check, additional measures involved. We specifically measured that program. We know exactly how successful it is and where the gaps are in that program. I just think it's misleading to say that there's no outcome measures.
And I completely agree with you. I think where we got caught up with their definition is, what you just said, is that specifically identified in the plan? And he was pretty clear on that, and it got us to thinking about next year, how we want to maybe design our plan to actually have that information in there. Specifically says outcome, a section on outcome measures, even if we didn't mention it. But that we have items that are specifically, but I agree with you. We it's not that we're not doing it. It's just how are we identifying it in the plan with his context of his question.
I think we'll take a big step back.
Yeah.
Whether it's in the plan or not, it's what we're doing.
Yeah.
And I think that's the context. We can always manage paper, but if we're actually doing the work, we should take credit for the work.
Yes, Director Albert.
I believe in the plan we do talk about how our substance use treatment programs are part of a statewide system to collect outcome measures. These outcome measures are designed against the national outcome measures. That's why we are able to give at a moment's notice the information to the board. That information is collected, is specific to 8109, the Department of Alcohol and Drug Revenue, identified a very specific data element so that we could identify the 8109. In our own electronic medical record, we have client identifiers, we know exactly who's on 8109. So we have all those systems, and all those systems are also included in our portion
of writing about our substance use treatment. I would also go back and say, if you recall, the original request for budget allocations were based on national studies that told us what the prevalence was of alcohol and drugs in the criminal justice system. My projections as much as, you know, it floored everyone and said, oh no, that's too much. They were still based on national prevalence data. They are based on the information that we have specific to Kern County. So I would also like to see this change to reflect that this committee did in fact was presenting the information, and it did make budget decisions based on the information. And we do collect the information ongoing. It is in our
company. I'd like to just mention, I think every department here is collecting information and data on their outcomes and what they're doing. I understand what Becky's saying. According to the state, we had to do it a certain way, not just mention it in your narrative. However, I also think we should put down what we did, the outcome of it, and let them decide whether or not they're going to accept it or not. And if they reject it, they say, no, you didn't, then, you know, we'll let them decide. But I agree. I think we should change that.
I just need, I have two questions, one clarification. You said number five? The second question is, what are the outcome measures that you would specifically or not to say yes and the following?
If you want to update sidebar, send me an electronic email, let me respond for our system.
It won't be hard to articulate that. I don't think it differs from what we put forward, but that we measured retention rates in the jail program, transition to the community program, and successful completion of the community program. Those were in the plan, and those were things that were being measured.
And I don't think Becky needs any more information. She can take that information out of the plan itself, out of the narrative, and put it in the format. So
if you want, would like me to do that.
But we can do that. So, but is there a motion for that change? I think we need to have a motion.
I'll make a motion to approve the
outcome
measures for 2015.
Are there any other comments or changes in the other report? Gina, okay.
I haven't really time to look at it. The rankings on like the question 10 and 11. You have just a 1 minute to just tell us what the rankings represent.
The rankings on these particular groups, on each year they ask for it. Basically, they're the same on each year. That they want to send the priority areas of the CCT and where the, basically where the, based on the dollars and how we're spending that money. And I took a stab at it in terms of where, based on what was in the plan, where those priority areas were. And that's basically it. And they said, like I said, this is kind of interesting. You can see how they're the ones present. They don't give you any other options other than these particular items, these 8 items.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments regarding the report? Any public comments regarding the report that gave us today? I see none, then I will need a motion and a second to amend.
Chief,
remarks regarding number 8, and most of often when we talk about allocation, excuse me, and specific program that is going to be discussed here. So if I can make reference to this report later, I can hold off on this.
Is this the purpose of time? Yeah, I don't think so. Okay, so in order to make these changes, I will need a motion for that in a second. I would make a motion that on questions number 5 and 7, we change it from no to yes, and we allow the chamber to get to the appropriate verbiage in the comment box. Second for that? Second by, motion was made by Director Maricol, second by Sheriff Jenslett. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? Very good. Yeah. Okay, item number 9, this is regarding the AB-109 growth funding. At this point, I'm going to go through a little bit regarding this funding that was determined by, PSAC and with the RAC. And we got, this was, the money was, I think the PSAC worked very hard in showing that we got very little money. We were flat and per offender through the money we received. Because of that, we received over 10% of that funding for Kern County, which is $8.9 million. So I think that was very good. But also, this funding is meant for certain purposes, is to either create or enhance services here. And it, within Government Code Section 3002.07, it does state the Department of Finance shall consider a county's commitment to continuing, expanding, and initiating community correction practices, programs, and strategies that manage felony offender populations. But well, I'm not going to read all of it, but this was at the end of this code section, but they are also, and they mentioned specific programs like the use of offender risk teams, assessment tool, which we do, criminogenic base information, substance abuse, mental health treatment, and additional treatment and sanctions other than traditional jail incarceration alone, or routine probation supervision as well as community-based programs. So I think we have to all keep in mind what this money was meant for. I think we also have to understand, too, they will be looking at this, and if we do not use the money properly, I think it could hurt us in the long run with the final percentage that we receive, the formula that we receive, because once they determine that proportion 15, it's my understanding that that's the permanent formula. And so I think, you know, we were short money in the original. They gave us a little extra, and they want to do it. So I, with that in mind, you know, what we would like to do is hear some proposals from the different departments of the amount, what you want to do, and I think what we'll do again is just go in order of who we can get the money, and we'll just work our way down. So, please.
Sure. Chief, can I add something? The last time this body determined the use of the loan fund, the amount of money less than we currently have, but the body chose to spend more than we currently have. And the formula was created, and I think it was $1 million or $1.5 million overspent, with the intent that that money would be, if the growth occurred, that money would be allocated in those areas. And I think there were spreadsheets that were done, and this committee voted on that percentage. So your body has already taken a position. Now, you can always change that position, but you've already taken a position based on percentages, dollar amounts, in order to absorb the first level of growth and the second level of growth. And that may be a place to start for the dialogue. It's not brand new. I mean, it's not as if we're bringing new ideas to the table. We've already had some of this discussion, and then as you want to adjust that.
Bianca, for purposes of clarification, was the previous decision that was made and endorsed to allocate a portion of it based on the initial funding allocation?
Well, I there was a great deal of discussion on how that money should be used.
Well, if we've been, you know, as I guess a matter of procedure, if the matter has already been decided, is there a basis to justify its reconsideration in terms of efficient organization and operation?
My understanding was that we kind of already spent, I believe it's about $1.2 million here thus far. And we didn't know what the growth money was going to be at the time. We had an estimate. I think we ended up getting more than we even thought we would. So I would encourage, in my opinion, that 1.2 that's already in our CCP plan, that kind of comes off the top of the growth money that we discussed, the rest of what we do with it.
And out of the 100% of the $8.9 million, Director Maracle was correct. It's $1.249 million that we set aside and overspent at that time. We will, we have a charger that deducts that from $8.9 million. So what that does is leave us with $7.7 million to work with for the enhancement program. So, instead of 8.9, we are looking at 7.7. But if this committee agrees to that. Yes, Supervisor Perkins.
Oh, Chief Kube, thank you. I think it's becoming more apparent from the state through these surveys, and I appreciate all your hard work, Becky, what the state is prioritizing and how they want us to think about these monies and how they want us to track data, present data, prioritize where it is we want services to be. And I think the survey is extremely telling, and they're leading questions mostly. But certainly, I believe they want to see what our outcome measures are and how we are determining our success and how the state can believe that we are moving successfully towards those outcome measures. And so when I look at number 8 on the survey, it says, the question is, the county has increased the number of community corrections programs and or services, e.g., they list 3 areas, substance abuse treatment, employment workshops, and housing assistance. And it says, what did you offer that to offenders fiscal year 2011-12 through 2013-14? And so then we have some explanation here written out by Becky. I think there's a small typo in the third paragraph that says we allocated nearly $1 million to a CBO program. I think we allocated $1 million to 7 CBO programs. I think it was about $300,000 to 1 CBO who is present today. But that we did that to multiple CBO programs. Right? So when I look through here at what we have to present to the state about what it is we're doing and how we're prioritizing these dollars, I do see the substance abuse treatment being offered both in custody and to highlight the numbers that you've presented to the county. We've had remarkable success there. So hats off to you, Donnie, and Mr. Waterman for the great work you're doing to get folks in custody drug treatment programs. Also see their employment workshops, paid work experience through ECR. That's absolutely fantastic. I'd love to hear more details about that if we focus some of that on AD 109 folks and how successful that has been. But I am concerned about the last area, which is the housing assistance, because I don't see in this in this drop-down menu any explanation at all about housing assistance. And it would appear to me that it would be very difficult to maintain any level of success, either in an employment workshop or substance abuse treatment, to be continued post-incarceration if folks are not getting some housing assistance. I know one of our PBOs is here and focuses on providing housing along with drug treatment and with a PCR program. So that's fantastic. That, of course, is limited to 40 beds. But I do think some explanation of that, of the housing assistance that's offered through New Life Recovery Training Center would be helpful. But it does concern me that I don't see anything beyond that, such as working with the housing authority to prioritize maybe some housing for folks that are moving through post-incarceration, and Flood Ministries, for example, that does an outstanding job and are uniquely situated to help people get stabilized through some kind of housing system. And so when I look at this report, I say, okay, this looks to me like some kind of roadmap from the state in terms of what they're looking from us to determine whether or not, one, we're setting out guidelines, measurements, and are we engaging in these 3 points, which they have clearly believed are critical to the success of post-incarceration. And so when I think about the 7.7 that we have remaining, it really appears important to me that we are focusing some of this money through the folks we know in the community that are uniquely situated to help people with some stable housing so that they can focus on their employment program through ECR and other folks and other places and continue their substance abuse treatment. So those are my initial thoughts.
And perhaps I should have let you speak during that when we were talking about the survey, because we most certainly can add, you know, even though they limit us to certain programs, we can add in the comments section. Like you were saying, that I think that would be beneficial. That we've gone above and beyond what they're asking. So, Dr. Watson.
Embedded in the mental health and substance abuse dollars are housing programs. I mean, we house people in sober living environments, for example, while we're getting them stabilized and treatment. We spend a significant amount of money on that through the mental health department, in addition to the CDOs.
Okay.
It just doesn't sort of stand out as a separate environment.
Should we use that mental health?
Yeah.
Okay. Should we have used that something?
I think that the real question is correct. When we allocate the money to the CDOs in the second year, the private, each executive committee member had a number, and they decided the private, we all decided the priority was how they was an institution. So that was a priority when they allocated that $1 million. All those groups, put, along with, you know, 35 others, did get a meeting to support housing as a priority. So that was before you were a member of this group, and I don't know if you were aware of that. So that was a priority. All these groups, what they brought to the table first was housing, and then some of them had other programs. That was my understanding. Having said that, I have a question for the sheriff, which no fault of the sheriff's department. My understanding that the individuals now who are accessing the drug treatment programs in the jail are not accessing them because they want to get out sooner because they're being released because the jail is overcrowded. So what seemed like a success at the beginning, I think, may not be a success now. I don't know if that's true, but that's my understanding. Is that what you're seeing?
I think there is some truth to that, right? But you might want to address that.
We're actually starting to see the opposite. We're starting to see more sentenced inmates stay in jail. About 32% of the inmates are sentenced. 2 years ago, it was about 15 to 18% of our inmates were sentenced and serving time. We're at 32% as of today. Our drug treatment program, we're expanding. We went to the board 2 weeks ago to have more full-time substance abuse counselors. We actually have a waiting list for people to get into the program. So we're kind of seeing the opposite because we're putting the focus on, if you don't participate in the program, if you're serving a year or more, you're not going to get out early. So we are still releasing people a year or less, but the long-termers, a year or more, you have to participate in the program.
So if they don't, they opt not to participate, then they're not believed that you're
trying to serve their time. We're trying to make them serve a higher percentage. I'm not going to say they're going to serve their full sentence,
right,
but they're serving upwards 40, 50, and 60% of their sentence.
Is there any tracking either in your department or in the other departments that you see when they are, when inmates from the jail are entering then the post-incarceration aspect of the drug counseling?
There is. When we release somebody, we release them through mental health through the gate, and they capture that data. That was kind of the discussion earlier where we're keeping track of the in-custody part. We then send that data over. It's a mutual program, and they capture that data, who reports, who completes the treatment.
Thank you. And I would just like to say that I certainly feel that we should allocate more of those growth funds to the CBO, whether it's for directly for housing or some other area that's
I think that's what the intent of the money
is for. I just wanted to follow up with Greg's comment about 90% of the people who are leaving Laredo Matrix are entering into substance abuse treatment. So we're following that data. We're able to see that specifically why this partnership is working is because all of our substance abuse treatment programs connected, networked with our gate, and so we know exactly within an hour whether or not the inmate arrives or not, and so Sheriff's Department doesn't have to deploy just going out randomly looking. They now know specifically if they need to look for someone. So it's a very tight network that we've created. I'd like to just add a couple of other things for your consideration. With the implementation of healthcare reform, one of the byproducts of that will be the loss of the federal block grant. And if you look at the data, you will see that approximately 23% of the people coming into treatment are being paid for, not with AB-109 dollars, but with that SASE block grant. So it is possible that we would see a significant loss in those dollars in the future. The other thing that you would want to recognize is that in the state of Massachusetts, when they originally started out with universal health care, that 20% of the population that did not sign up for were addicts and the mentally ill. They probably lead some of the most chaotic lives, and it's very difficult for them to enroll. And so the loss of these discretionary dollars, because we won't be able to get everyone enrolled, is going to be significant. So I also just want to clarify that the CBO contracts are not for treatment. They are for housing. They are for vocational. They are for case management. So, but they do not deliver the treatment. And so what we want to make sure is that people recognize that treatment programs or substance abuse treatment is delivered in certified licensed facilities by certified counselors.
I believe I cut off.
Lily, is it the case that none of the CBOs that we awarded nearly $1 million to provide actual and technical substance abuse treatment according to the state requirements? Because many of them do provide some counseling, but according to your representation, they do not meet or satisfy the actual requirements. Correct. None of this has been awarded the million.
Correct.
Nothing negative about that, or something is not meaningful.
It's
not technically.
Any other?
Excuse me, can I, a little bit more clarification. I don't want to make it sound like that's correct.
Sure.
The people that are going through the in-custody drug treatment program that are released are being released to the CBOs, being referred back to the gate, and then mental health is getting the substance abuse treatment. So we are part of this $1 million. They are getting treatment.
Physically at the CBO.
Right. They're coming back, being re-referred through gate from the home back to gate 30.
Any other, and I would ask that the public please wait until I ask the public comment, but is there any other comments or questions by the committee members?
I have another question. Is it, does it make sense to have some outpatient substance abuse treatment happening at the actual CDO with your counselor going to a site like Newland, for example, that has 40 beds, is actively engaged in housing, monitoring, transporting folks to work sites? That's a lot of work for one organization to undergo. So to have them then transport individuals on individual plans through mental health into substance abuse treatment seems like a lot to me. Is that something that's working? Is that a model that we should think about tweaking? You know, what does that look like?
I believe it was a few years ago that I really encouraged New Life to become drug medical certified. They did not move forward. We will not be able to purchase any drug medical services from a physical location that is not certified by the state. I do not have the authority at the local level to certify. That only resides at the state. But there is nothing keeping from New Life from becoming a certified drug medical health program than they would come to us for a different source of funding.
Do all of those folks have to go to your office in order to receive the treatment? Or can someone in your employ be at the facility, the CBO, providing that counseling?
95% of the treatment is contracted out to community-based organizations. We do not.
That is exactly what you were asking. On the substance abuse side, there's no such thing as a field treatment or treatment at a non-certified site.
Okay.
So no, that we can't send our staff. On the mental health side, we can send staff to a school or a home or whatever, to a group built for that. On the substance abuse side, it can only happen in an actual certified site.
So in theory, if that site is certified, you could send folks there to do the substance abuse treatment?
We'd pay them actually a month program.
I see.
Either way.
Okay.
Right. Any other questions or comments from the commission? Okay, any... yes,
very quickly, I think Louie alluded to the loss of funding. Just to put a scope on that, that's potentially up to $1 million in loss. So one of the things we'll struggle with here today is how much... I mean, we don't know exactly what's going to happen. Do we lock in all these dollars as if we really know the whole plan feels today? Or do we leave some flexibility to fill gaps as they arise?
Well, I think that'll come up in the discussion where we want to allocate the funding, if we want to put in contingencies to see, but, you know, maybe not all of it, but a portion of it, to see where the need will be later on. But, you know, most certainly that could be part of the plan. Mr.
Yes.
Public Treasurer Board.
I'm not certain if I understood the answer to my initial question as related to the point made by Mr. Nylon. Did the committee, did this body previously make any judgments relating to supplemental funding that speak to the question before the
I believe what the committee decided, I think we probably didn't finalize it today, but when we made our allocation in the plan, for the fiscal year, we acknowledged we were going to take $1.2 million of growth money to supplement to make the plan. So I think we still have to make that decision, but I think that was everyone, that was my understanding, that was everyone's saying that we would then, we all have the salary taken in, that we would supplement those salary savings with the fiscal
growth. And I, you know, we did all in concept agree with that, but that will be probably part of the motion today. To finalize that, make sure that that's what everybody was doing. Is that?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Anybody from the public would like to comment on this?
Yes.
Come up, please state your name and the organization you're from.
Good morning. My name is Karen McCormick. I'm with the Women of Worth Recovery Help. I did just want to clarify, we do have three locations, and one is a state-licensed residential treatment facility, and we are in the process of becoming drug mental health.
Thank you.
Yes, please state your name and organization.
My name is Lynn Huckabee, and I'm the owner of Freedom House. So I'm getting out of my comfort zone here. I've never done this. Some of us at home and operate recovery homes for actual substance abuse counselors. And I have two on my staff as actual substance abuse counselors. We've never went through the hoops as far as to be IOP intensive outpatient classes. But what we do is we transport them to 12-step programs per meeting. And I believe that's a form of group therapy. And we also transport them to Celebrate Recovery, which is a faith-based program. So we get them there. So they are getting, per se, you know what I mean? Because to me, and a lot of us in the recovery field, we believe that, you know, another addict or another alcoholic helping another is without parallel, as the paper saying it's gone. So they do get that. And it is, and we do have them do X amount of meetings weekly. You know, we do hold meetings in the recovery home, the 12-step meetings, which to me is a form of counseling and a form of group therapy. I just want that to get out there. Thank you.
For the benefit of the public, are you a recipient of the any dollars?
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
It's not mine, so I'm sorry. How do you pronounce your last name?
H-U-C-K-A-B-Y.
Huckabee.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I just didn't hear you. I just had a question about the statistics, the trackers for the second quarter. It indicates that you had a total of 8 referrals with 3 walkaways. How does that compute to a fail rate of 11%? Because in my brain, that's a fail rate of 40%. I'm not understanding, and I'm assuming you provided those statistics to probation, and James.
I don't have my sheets with me, so there's no way I can...
Well, it indicates you had 8 total referrals, and there were 3 walkaways. Did you bring the walkaways back into the program to where they then...
I actually did a couple.
Okay. So, if I say walkaway, that would necessarily mean that they failed. That the team, they left, and you brought them back, and they completed the program?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I think we need more
clarification on that. We'll talk about the presentation on the
Thank you.
Any other comments? From New Life Residential Facility, and just to make a comment in terms of why we haven't moved forward with the Medi-Cal certification. We initially opened our facility with AB-109, and so we've been focusing our efforts on making sure we implement a successful program now, and we look to expand any opportunities in the future, but we started January with our first clients from AB-109. And also, we do 90% of the people who are coming from custody already are enrolled or have an appointment to continue their treatment with a substance abuse treatment program. And so I say 90% of the people who are in our program and have a substance abuse related conviction are in a treatment program. And when they come from probation, part of our assessment initial 30 days is to see what their needs are, and if substance abuse is one of the things that they need, then we refer them over to the GATE team and enroll them in treatment. We also transport to NA as sobriety support services and Celebrate Recovery through Canyon Hills for sobriety support. And we have on-site mentoring through ex-offenders who have successfully reintegrated as part of our sobriety support program.
Supervisor Perez, even though we allocate money for a fiscal year, the contracts are on a calendar year, so they start at January 1st. So really, they're 10 months into this. They're not like, you know, we had the extra 6 months to work with before that.
And just for the record, you know, my questions really are focused on how do we make their jobs and lives easier. You know, if there are ways to connect the dots in a way that's smoother and doesn't, you know, cause more stress on top of what is already a very difficult, stressful, chaotic line of work. You know, that's what I want to be poignant for. You know, we're here to make your life easier because you're doing a job that, quite frankly, we personally cannot do. So I appreciate everything that you're doing, and I want to figure out ways in which we can, you know, connect those dots, make it easier, smoother, faster, stronger, so you're getting more guys and gals in and out of your program.
Thank you.
Being drug medic, health certified makes your life a lot more complicated. And so it's a mixed blessing, but it also opens the door to leveraging funds in a way that we don't currently do it in our CBOs because of health care reform and the availability of people to be on Medi-Cal and pay for their warmth of their substance use treatment. So it's a trade-off. And the individuals providing those services are going to find it a kind of an arduous and frustrating process to be certified. But I think it's important that we continue to help them.
What's the hate process to this issue?
It only gets worse.
Part of the observation I've made over the last few years, I was previously a public defender, and now in the role I'm currently in, is really noting a tremendous gap between so many folks in the community that are uniquely situated to deliver these services. Because they're close to the community, they come from the community, really have a unique heart for people and helping people transition into a place of stability. And yet what's on the other side, which is an incredibly complicated bureaucracy, which is important for transparency and for credibility and all these other components of the system that make it something of integrity. But the gap between that is significant. And we can, you know, really point to decades-old decisions on realignment dollars here in the Central Valley that we know has left us out of the process in very significant ways that have caused us not to be able to build the kind of capacity that you see in places like the Bay Area, places like Los Angeles, and areas that are more popular places to invest real dollars into these kind of programs that we know are successful. So I think part of what we should be thinking about here is how do we help folks like New Life, take that next step? How do we invest some dollars to build capacity so that organizations, CEOs in town that really are uniquely situated to deliver the service, get the assistance on the bureaucratic side because they're going to yield a benefit. We will yield a benefit over time that I think is absolutely profound. So that should be part of this discussion. How do we help the CBO that are uniquely situated to deliver this service build the bureaucratic capacity side so that we're reaching more people and be more successful? I think that's a critical part of how we reach this population and be successful and show the state that we're being creative and thinking outside the box.
No, I agree. I apologize for my comment. I'm just trying to be funny. But.
All right, anybody else?
Please state your name and your organization.
Good morning. I'm Vincent Caldeos with Positive Visions from Inns. We're one of the contracted CBOs. I just wanted to be in support of this discussion being had this morning. One of the items I just wanted to note that the actual dollars go further when you support a CBO because you don't necessarily have a high cost or the intensity of residential dollars being on a daily basis, on a daily rate. So your dollars as a purchaser go a lot further, and I think Lily and her department would be in support of what I'm coming. We've been a provider for Kern County Metro for about going on our 14th year. We were a provider under SACPA services. We definitely see the lives transformed, as Leticia stated. It's on a case by case, one at a time. I support all the CBOs here today because they've been plowing, just their hands been at the plow to help change the individual lives. But I would just urge to continue to look at that area because I know that the residential dollars can only go so far. And I think that the CBOs are doing a wonderful job in helping you get the maximum for your return on the dollars. Thank you. Anybody have any questions?
Any questions for
Okay. Ms. Green?
Well, I do, but I guess we're taking it up later. On the success of these programs, is that right?
We're going to have a report.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
we'll
I'll
report on
that. Now. Thank you.
Okay. Please state the name and organization.
My name is John Caput. I'm the executive director of the Kern County Hispanic Commission. We have 10-bed residential women's facility and intensive outpatient program for women only. First off, I want to say I'm in support of anything you can do for the CBOs because one of the things that we found with our success rate is that our women who are successful have a safe place to stay. Those that drop off a lot of times, we don't always know the reason why they drop out, but we do know that one of the factors of success is having a safe place to stay. That being said, I also would add that our outpatient facility has capacity for treatment. We have 71 slots. We rarely get anywhere close to that. I'm just saying that we have room for treatment. So, I mean, they're not just the CBOs can begin to offer treatment eventually, but we already do. And I believe BRS does also, Bakersfield Recovery Services. So, any questions?
Good morning. I'm Janet Hatfield with New Heart Family Center, and I just wanted to say that what Leticia is saying and everyone is saying is really right. One of the big issues is for housing, and I just want to let everyone know that we are not at capacity. So, you know, we're only 20 beds right now that's being funded, and we have a capacity of 40 beds at our facility, so we welcome the additional because that's what we really set up to do. So in deliberating how we can increase residential space, you know, we can use those extra 20 beds, you know, that are just sitting there, you know, if you consider that. And so one of the, also the other thing that I'd like to mention is too is that a really large percentage of our population that comes to our facilities do have drug problems. And sometimes we are not aware of that until we do an intake. And so transitioning those people into substance abuse treatment has really been a big push for us. And also, some of our outcomes may not be as wonderful as we want them to be in terms of employment and vocational training because we have to consider, you know, what's best for that person at the time, and treatment and getting into sobriety is definitely better than trying to force that person to go through employment and vocational training. So as you look at, and I'm prefacing, as you look at some of our outcome statistics, we are doing a good job in terms of getting people employed, getting people on the right track. And employment goes beyond just getting a job. It's getting people ready to go to work, those work documents, those kind of things, getting birth certificates, ID, and those things like that. But, again, our biggest push and our biggest issue has been focused on, you know, the really 90% of those who have substance abuse problems. And that's who we're seeing with the non-non-non. They do have a lot of substance abuse issues and a lot of other issues that we have to take care of before we begin to look at employment and vocational training.
I've been to your facility. It's beautiful. Your dorm-style housing is very, very nice. And also secure, which is important. Right now you said you're housing 20. And you could do 40. You know, that's a lot, obviously, of people to monitor. Do you have the capacity and the staff and the ability to properly monitor 40 people?
That's why I really like what you said about giving us the capacity. I mean, it's beyond just having people there and watching over them. It's the organizational capacity that needs to be built up in order to do that. We have the facility, and we certainly would need the staffing that would go along with that. We just can't add 20 people there with the same staff.
Right.
I mean, that's a no-brainer. So we have to increase our capacity to be able to do that, and we would need the dollars to be able to do that. But if we have the facility, we have the capability, we just need the capacity.
Any other questions from this? Okay.
Lorraine Castro, Turning Point of Central California. Something that I want to piggyback on what Jan said is a critical barrier for getting to sustainability and getting back into the community is funding for birth certificates and ID, California IDs. Because when post-incarceration, you can't do anything without that. 4 years ago, we started a program called Integrated Services for Mentally Ill Parolees at Turning Point in the Kenmore Center. These are all co-occurring disorders. They have schizophrenia, they have substance abuse issues, and they have physical health like hepatitis C. Their recidivism rate is typically in the 80%. In the first 4 years of our program, our recidivism rate was 10%. With 219 clients, because we provided those basic things that they needed besides the emotional support
and a clubhouse center area where they could come in and be safe and get out of the street. We pay for all those kind of things, those basic things. So I would urge you to include something for that in the additional funding with whichever the CBO is that you're supporting, that you put in an element of funding for those critical parts of sustainability.
Anybody else from the public would like to comment?
Good morning, everyone. I'm with WestCare, and just to kind of piggyback on what Vin just said, my name is Robert Scott, and I'm supervising case manager at WestCare. And I'm in charge of the AB 109 program, but we also do have a residential program, as well as we have a substance abuse program, as well as FAFSA. But I'm here to talk about AB 109 today specifically, because we are the newest program. And basically, to kind of discuss what everybody's already kind of gone over, we're an outpatient program. And what we do is we do case management. And our program is 6 months long. So specifically what we do is when clients come to us, they're either sent to us by the gay team, they're sent to us through the sheriff's department, or they're sent to us by probation. So we have 35 clients that are specifically from probation, and 35 clients that are sent to us specifically from the sheriff's department. So myself and the other case manager, our job is to make sure that obviously they have the supportive services that they need, one of those being housing, which is obviously the premier thing that a client needs for stability when they get back in the community. We also obviously work on making sure that the client stays sober, so we will refer them back to the gay team. Because we are only a case management team, we do have substance abuse, and the gay team can refer them back to our program as well as the other CBOs that we work with. And like everyone else said, all of us as CBOs go to the meetings, we discuss with each other what the needs are of the clients that are coming back into the community, because we realize substance abuse is a huge problem. Clients needing housing, hygiene, clothing, bus passes, all these things contribute to whether they can get to your program as well as if they can get around the community, get jobs, get to where they need to go. So really what all of the CBOs need, as well as WestCare, is assistance with that. And obviously usually that's monetary, because obviously the things that we're providing for them cost money. Just to give you a little background about WestCare AB 109 program.
Your time is up, so can you kind of wrap up?
Sure. We have about 31 clients that are going to be graduating through the program in the next 2 months. We started off with 20 clients 6 months ago, and now we have 80 clients that are in our program. And like I said, about 31 of those are scheduled to graduate. And we've had only 10 report back to custody and that have been reported to us, and 12 that have reported a positive drug test. So really what we try to do is stay informed with probation, stay informed with the sheriff's department, work collectively with our housing and other areas, and just make sure that we're on top of them being accountable. Myself and the other case manager will go into the community and go to their houses. We'll do whatever it takes to make sure that the clients stay on task and that we can assist them with all their needs.
Thank you. Any comments or questions?
So, Mrs. Scott, you said you have 80 clients, 31 are getting ready to graduate, so the other 49 is not that far along in the program.
Well, we're working collectively with the Sheriff's Department, and 42 of the clients are in pre-release. So they're currently, we're working with them while they're in custody, and then the hope is to have them come out into our program and help them through the program.
So the 31 who are graduating, finishing your program, how long was that program?
The program is 6 months. So all of them have been required to come to programming weekly, as well as meet with us, do their NA meetings, anything else that is asked of them by the referring officer or they're mandated to do, and we assist them, of course, with that, whether it be domestic violence or any of the issues that they may have. But 6 months they are required to come and meet with us on a daily basis in order to complete the program.
Are any of those 31 people of the 12% who have had failed the drug test, or any of those 31, did they fail the drug test?
There have been four that have relapsed, and then we work collectively to make sure that that doesn't occur again. There are some that if they get taken back, we will talk to the Sheriff's Department on probation to find out if they would like to have them come back into our program. We've had three that are back into our program because they didn't stay in jail very long. So they just came right back into the program. They already know the program, and we work with them to try to ensure that that doesn't occur again.
And do those 31 have jobs?
Out of those 31, we have 40% of the clients are working either part-time or full-time. And then 12.5% of those clients are on SSI. So about 50%, a little bit more, about 52%, have some kind of funding coming or money coming in each month to assist them with their daily needs.
Any other questions?
What about housing and transportation for the population that's on CAG in the back?
Okay. Well, because we are an outpatient program, most of our clients do either live at home with friends or they have some place that they go to. But once again, we do work collectively. We have partnerships with many of the CBOs that you've already spoken to that do have AV-109 beds. And my job is to make sure that there are beds available if our client comes in and needs that as a secondary place to go, or if they get in a situation where they cannot stay at the housing that they're currently at. So we've already formed relationships with many of the community-based organizations in order to ensure that our clients have housing.
Do you start the drug treatment while they're in custody of the 31 highlighted earlier? Are those folks that you started providing services to while in custody?
No, this is something that we're trying to work out right now with the Sheriff's Department as well as mental health. This is a new program that is separate from the program that we currently do. The clients are referred directly to us, and their needs are determined as we meet with them and do their intake. For the most part, like I said, most of the clients already have housing, so the other areas that we are looking to get funding to assist them with are transportation, like day passes, in order for them to get to and from our programming, as well as get out in the community, look for jobs. Once again, like I said, about 40% of our clients are working, so most of our clients do have the ability to work on resumes. They have had jobs in the past. I was a former job developer, so I try to assist them with that, or find other areas like the Career Center and places where they can go to get the assistance that they need in order to put the resume together and find, you know, job placement.
Thanks.
Any other comments or questions?
Thank you
very much. Anybody else in the public like to make a comment at this time? Okay, I see none. We're going to go to 9A, which is a request for vocational training program for 109 Director LaRouche.
Good morning. Bob LaRouche with the Kern County Parks and Recreation Department. I believe all of you got a copy of the proposal. Basically, I've been working with Jan from the New Life Recovery and Training Center to establish a training program by using these participants in our park setting. As a background, our department has worked with many programs in the past. As an example, work release we currently use, we use community service, we use the SERV program, CalWORKS, as well as a few others. So we have a background of working with folks that are not actually experienced in some of these areas, such as groundskeeping and maintenance. And so the concept is really to take the folks that are already in the New Life Recovery Training Center program and actually be able to provide them some work experience in the park settings that we have in those areas of maintenance, groundskeeping. I'm sure many of you are aware, by just looking around town, of many of the folks that have businesses, by driving around with their truck and a truckload or a trailer of lawn equipment, and they're able to make a living by doing that. The example we were thinking about is if we can get these folks to train in some of those areas in terms of irrigation, in terms of landscaping maintenance, they've got the skills that potentially they can use down the road in terms of work, either getting picked up in those areas or actually starting some kind of a business down the road. One of the issues that your board brought up before was the issue of the stipend. And in the program here, talking with Jan, we thought it would be a good idea if they completed the program, that at the end of the program, they would get a $1,500 stipend. And the concept is, if they can get a stipend like that after going through the program and completing it, that can also help them to pay off some of the things that they have that are listed in the program here. So again, these are participants who are already in the New Life Recovery Training Center. We would work with them through some type of agreement, talked with our county council, who happens to be Kendra Graham here today, to work out an agreement where we could work with them within the program to get more funding. The other difference from the previous time that I was here is the number of participants. We reduced that participant number down to 5 per quarter. So we have 2 quarters within the year. So that's where you see the dollar difference from the $25,000 previously to the $15,000 we're requesting today. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have, or potentially Jan may be able to answer any specifics regarding some of the participants from her program.
Okay, any comments or questions from supervisors?
Bob, thank you for your creativity in these matters. We know we've lost funding in our Parks and Rec division over the last several years, and we paid the price because our parks are not as clean as they could be. Our families aren't as drawn to the parks. So then with families gone, they tend to attract criminal elements, and identity becomes a place not for families and a place for other folks, which is not good for any of us. So the idea that we could use some AB-109 guides to help clean, they're not being paid, obviously, so the county is receiving a benefit there tremendously, but also getting some work experience by which they could get some certificates, something to feel good about, and some hopefulness about the future, I think is really critical. But with this population, because it's a small, it is a small accomplishment that is manageable, it's not overwhelming, it's something that is really, manageable. So I really applaud your efforts to think creatively, to think outside the box, because the county needs the service desperately in our parks. Our families need clean parks. And I think a manageable accomplishment for these guys is a worthwhile investment. And I would strongly support it.
Thank you, Supervisor Perez. I might also mention, and I mentioned this previously, a lot of the folks that come through our programs that we're currently have, we do have issues from time to time with these folks, so just please be aware that this is not something that's 100% successful. But on the flip side of it, we have people that we've actually hired in our department that are still working today that came out of the work with these programs. So we do have examples where people are able to get those work experiences and actually participate and get a job down the road, which is what I think we all want.
Any other questions? Director, I have one. The $15,000 you're asking for, are you asking for that to go to your department, then to be out, or is that, how does that work?
It's a great question, and if you read my proposal, I specifically did not say that. And the reason why I didn't is I am totally open to whatever your board feels most comfortable with. Jan and I talked about that. Jan would like it to come through our department. But I'm from the mindset that if your board wants it to come through us or through Jan's program, I'm willing to work either way. Again, I've already had discussions with our council, and we can work the agreement whichever way this board feels is appropriate.
I just have
one question, and the question is this. If these figures are accurate on the upcoming issue that we're going to be discussing, and it looks like, I don't have that right in front of me, but it looks like New Life has expended 52% of their funding for vocational training. That's in one of these documents. So if that's the case, then why are we being asked to give another $15,000, which isn't a huge amount, but it's a significant amount. Why are we being asked to give another $15,000 to this program if New Life has unallocated funds that they could put towards this program? That is my question.
And unfortunately, I wouldn't be able to answer that.
I know, probably for Jan. Unless the statistics or the figures are not accurate.
Although the figures are accurate, You know, when we got a budget, we had to stick by the budget that we presented, and that was, the Park and Rec was not, a stipend for participants was not in that budget, and we have not been allowed to do a budget modification to add that in. Second of all, those monies will be expended. I mean, we still have staffing, we still have programs yet to go, so that's why we have so much, we have money that looks like a lot, but when you actually divide it up into the remaining time, it'll all balance out. I also wanted to say, too, is that the money that would be given to folks who would be in that program is really a small stipend, and they would not receive that until the end of the program. A lot of these guys have fines. They have DMV, things that they need to pay for. There's no way, I mean, we don't have that allocated in our budget. So, I mean, this would be a way that they could actually begin to use the hard work that they've done, get an award for it, and then pay off some of the fines and things that they have. They have holds on their DMV, they have child support, they have restitution. Those, all of those things like that actually impede them from being on the job and being employed. So at the end of the time, if they get a little small stipend to be able to pay those things off, would really be helpful and really would work toward helping them on their way to employment. I mean, that's our final goal in terms of, you know, what we do with them is to make sure that they become self-sufficient, get a job. But all these other barriers that come up that they have no way. When we get guys in our program, they come with the clothes they have on their back. That's it. They don't have a lot of family support. Some of them have been incarcerated for long periods of time. There are no resources for them. And this would be a great incentive in a way that they can pay off and get right back into the workforce.
And I apologize for this, but I feel like sometimes you don't really understand the money and how it's spent. And I'm hoping that you can tell me that I'm wrong. It is the end of October. Your fiscal year runs out the end of December. That is two more months. What I'm seeing in the statistics is you have 48% unexpended funding for vocational training. If that is the case, my question is simple. Why can't you take that $15,000 from your unexpended 48% for vocational training and put that to the civil relief program? If I think this is a good program. I'm not sure how I feel about this stipend. I don't necessarily buy into what you're saying, but I respect your position on that. But that is my question. Why are we allocating another $15,000 if you have this unexpended money and
well, actually, if I'm looking right, I'm saying that was an estimate at June. So we've expended more than, I mean, June, July, August, September, and we're in October now. So, you know, we have already expended a lot of that money. So, you know, let's really look at the actual amount that we have left over. So, I mean, if that report was done in June, we've expended 4 months of that since then. So we do have a short period of time. And if we do have a large amount of money that's left over, that, I mean, we don't have a problem with that. We have a problem with budget modification. We have a line item budget that we have to stick to. I mean, we actually asked for a budget modification to be able to do other things. And we were told that we could not. So, that's why we can't do that unless you can come up with a way how we can do that and if there are any funds left over. But again, one of the things that I've been hearing all morning is that how do we giving money and what the state wants that money to go to in terms of, you know, helping CDOs and helping AB 109ers. So, I mean, $15,000 is not really a large amount of money that could go toward that, and we could say, you know what, this is an innovative program, we're working it out, and here's a model that maybe we can use that in other, not only in his department, but in other departments and in other counties. So, to pay that small amount, and the good that it would do, I mean, I hope that we could, you know, look at the greater good. Rather than looking at the small, well, you know, you have a little bit of money left over, why don't you use it yourself? We'd be happy to, but, you know, I think we can look at the greater good and see all the good things that will come out of that. You know, better helping our parks and recs, helping our guys pay off fines so that they can get in the workforce.
And the fines are for fines that they committed, are they not? I mean, that's what we're talking about.
Not all of them.
Not all of them.
Not all of them.
Of course they're not paying. It's their responsibility.
Well,
it's taxpayer money, right?
Well, some of it is not. But the fact remains that they still have to pay the fines. And so what they were for, I mean, I really do appreciate that your district attorney and yours is prosecution. We're CDOs and ours is helping. So, you know, I see what your point is, but the bottom line still remains is that they have these problems and we're trying to get past these barriers.
Will they not do the program? Will they not do the human resource program, which is vocational training, which is what we're trying to do, if they weren't given the stipend? Is that your feeling? That they, no one would...
I think it would be a greater incentive. I mean, in order to, I mean, 16 weeks is a long time to not get a dime. You know, and when we're trying to tell them, okay, you need to pay for diapers, you need to get back with your children, you need to do things, you need to be supportive of your family, and to go 16 weeks for free and saying, okay, well, I'll just donate 16 weeks of my time instead of getting out there and looking for a job. I mean, I think that they can use their time a little bit different.
But the big picture is the job training that they'll be able to, and what Ms. Hillary said is be able to basically get a job.
I think it's still going to skill. Yeah, they could if, you know, if they could look that far. I mean, I think a lot of them will. I mean, they're in our program because they think that they're going to be able to, you know, get enough skills. And they can say, well, Jan, I'm in your program. I'm getting skills here. I need a job. I can't afford to spend more time not getting myself ready to leave your facility and get out on my own and become a productive citizen.
So just the statistics that I'm looking at show through August 30th, so 52% non-vocational training through August 30th. Thank you.
Yeah, I just had, I guess, a question and a comment. My question is, because I'm familiar with the process in terms of the budgeting side of it, this program that we're looking at starting with the new life recovery and training center to start in January, so it'll be the new calendar year. So what I'm not sure of is the money that the district attorney is talking about that's being left over. Does that money stay with that CBO in the new calendar year, or does that go back to the pot? I guess that's my question, because I'm looking at would start this program in January. So I don't know how to answer that question. I know it's related to budget, but I'm just not sure how you folks handle that.
Well, that's what we're here to decide.
And then I had one comment, and try to phrase this correctly. I want it to be real clear, because I don't think it was very clear in the information that came out when I was here previously, that this money that we're talking about as a stipend can only be spent on AB19 participants. Not with other people that are not associated with AB109 that need job training, that need work experience, because those are some of the comments that we heard. I'm sure if you watch some of the media reports. So this money can only be spent in the AB109 program. And I just want to make sure that's real clear, because it did not come out that way last time.
Public
available.
Yes, can I ask Mr. Steele to back up? I wanted to just share that I come at it from a little bit different perspective. I wanted to compliment you on your trip, and to any other CBOs out there that are so efficient as to come to us at this point, having extended only 52%. It makes me a little uncomfortable when I see somebody on the hot seat for not having extended all their allocations. And I would say we don't ever want to get to a position where the question becomes, or the incentive becomes, you better spend your full allocation or face some challenging questions. I would think you also, included in your line item, would be in a difficult position if you were to say, well, yeah, we did do that. And it's like, how dare you have done that without authorization from the board? So I wanted to, one, compliment you on financial discipline. Mr. LaRue, the last time that this issue, this program was presented to the board, I think one of the concerns was So is it essentially tantamount to detain someone not to commit a crime? And I, from what I understand from reading your presentation is no, that in this, the way you framed it, it would seek to have volunteers. And this is a county that has a history of, a long history of using the stick. And so this is a request to spend $15,000 on reducing carrots. Would that be a correct...
Yes, I think if you look at the proposal after talking with Jan, again, I'm not really familiar, to be honest, with a lot of the things that these folks deal with, ABY participants in terms of things that they owe and those kind of things. So when Jan was telling me some of these kind of things, where they need to pay this off and they need to pay that off, I do think that that's an impediment to get a job. So to put a small stipend out there, if they run through a 16-week program, and these same people are folks that she's running through an educational program at Bakersfield College, and at the same time they're getting work experience that potentially can get them a job, I think for the little bit of money, again, this is my perspective, I think we can get a lot out of it.
Sheriff, I can be supportive of this program if the $1,500 does not go to control the person at the end of 16 weeks to do with what they want. If you took control of the money and paid your fines or whatever, I'd be a lot more amenable to supporting that type of program, because I don't think a lot of that $1,500 is going to go to what you think it's going to go for.
From my perspective, I'd be totally in support of that. I'm not sure how we can do it. We can work with council and work with Jan's program. Again, it benefits them in the long run if they're able to pay some of these things off with $1,500. But I'm not the legal expert to work that out with a contract.
And I want to respond to that too. We just don't have the capacity to micromanage that. We just really do not. I mean, our program, I mean, we have four staff people, and we're doing a heck of a lot without those four staff people. We do not have the capacity to micromanage that. We can set out a plan for them, but in terms of when they get ready to leave us and leave the program, that's it.
That's right.
You know, I have the same concerns as our sheriff, in all fairness, because just having worked with this population for as long as I have, I just have to be honest that I have the same concerns. With that said, I would be in favor of us thinking very creatively, because if this project works, and the creativity of what you're doing together, which is unique and unprecedented, then perhaps we could replicate this with various CBOs. And if it means that we allocate a person and some of their time to working with your clients to pay off some of their to pay off their client fees, which I know personally to be a major impediment. It's a major physical impediment, but it's also a major mental impediment. When people know that they have an exorbitant amount of fines and fees and barriers, that simply causes a lack of hope and a lack of incentive to get your act together, if you will. If there are benchmarks and small accomplishments that can be achieved that are reasonable, achievable, and not overwhelming, then folks can really be successful. I believe that. I've seen it work. But I have to be honest, I have the same concerns that our sheriff has. So I would like to see us be creative in moving forward and supporting this, because I think it's ingenious. I think it's the future. I think it's how we need to think about incentivizing small steps of progress and the ability for folks to actually take care of some of their fines and fees and obligations with money that they've actually earned. This isn't money that we're just handing folks, that they've earned it over 16 weeks of training, of getting themselves into a better lot in life. And so I'll cite one example is our driver's license. Most of these guys and gals have gotten their license taken away for a number of years. And the majority of the population we're working with are men. And for most of them, it's because of child support. Arrears of child support. And so what I have found is that the county can be very creative with giving folks an opportunity to start making payments on your driver's license, start making payments towards your child support, which they owe, which they're responsible for. But with regular 2 or 3 month payments, the hold on the license can be lifted, and then a person can actually be in a position where they're eligible for a job, because you often need to have the driver's license. To even qualify for a job, you're not even necessarily needing to drive at, but that's the first step in impediment of getting your foot in the door to have a job. And so I would have to reiterate the sheriff's concerns. I have the same concerns. I don't think we should hand folks $1,500 and just without any strings attached, because I don't think that will go very well. That's just my honest opinion. In fact, I'm sure of that. But if we could find a way to work with folks, either allocate someone from probation or someone somewhere along the way, this could be a model that we could use moving forward, where folks can gain stipends along with work experience to pay off particularly the child support, which I have found is the predominant issue with getting folks their driver's license unrestricted, so then they can even qualify for a job. The reality is we're talking about a population that really has almost no ability to qualify for a job. And it's a joke to think that this population can transition from being in custody to being eligible for a job. I mean, it's an absolute joke. So to the notion that we can provide a stipend, that is not a burden, I believe that. So that folks can pay off some of these, particularly the license. We really move a person into a place of complete hopelessness, into the possibility of working. And that's why I'm such a strong supporter. But I do agree
with you. But and we might even get probation to work with the criminal judge on fines that are to the court, not to child support, but the judge might be able to go back and waive that fine if they complete the program. It could be much higher than $1,500. And I would be amenable to that type of thing, not taking it from child support or victims that they owe. But handing the conversion cash, I think, is setting this program up to fail.
It's very hard for the county to actually pay somebody small amounts because the infrastructure costs more than what you're spending, and there are potentially rules against it in many cases. So we certainly would, community organizations like United Way, set up a fund we have for certain things. And all we do is we just find a little thing, send it over there, and then they'll pay the bill, they'll put them for money. So there are community organizations that can do that. Give them the pot of money that's designed to do this with an easy structure to pay things. That's doable.
Okay, yeah, and I don't know the legality. I mean, they work 16 weeks. They pay for it. Can we force them to pay just for certain things?
Sure.
You know, we can have an agreement. I don't know. It might be up to county council to advise us that, but I like Dr. Waterman's, suggestion that perhaps we give it to
the contract. We have a contract.
Yeah, contract with them to dispense that money. But if you drive the infrastructure to watch that, is more expensive than what it's at. So, anyway. Albert.
I'm just going to suggest that instead of working for a stipend, you're working to pay a particular fee or fine. You know, and if it's up front, you know, right at the very beginning, that's what you are signing up for. There aren't any hidden kinds of agendas. There isn't an expectation that this stipend is for you to use however you want. But rather you're finding out for something very specific, it's very upfront, this is an opportunity. So I also support some of these last comments as well.
I mean, I'm concerned that we're not giving enough credit to the human beings that we're talking about, that, oh, gee, you can't be trusted with money. I mean, the whole point is to work to reintegrate individuals. And the notion that I do X and this happens, to reinforce that, I volunteer, I work 16 months, I get $1,500, I think, or 16 weeks. That's what we want to infuse within the individual. Aha, the light goes on, I get a job, I work, I get the paycheck. Not that I do this work and then somebody, some greater source, some institutional source comes in and takes it and does it. I understand that there's the risk that certain individuals might not use the money responsibly. that presupposes, though, an expectation of failure. Rather than what we want to do is, just in the same way, the criminal justice system assumes you do X, you're going to get punished. We need to balance that with opportunity. We need to balance that with the reward system. Is that if they go through, they volunteer 16 weeks, get $1,500, that makes the life goes on. I work, I get paid. That's a very positive connection. And so I think that one of the things we're identifying in terms of discussing this laudable program, we go, gee, the infrastructure that's going to be required, gee, is there a county council issue? I mean, we're identifying tremendous problems with the discussion of $15,000, where a simple solution would be, when we're dealing with cutting up or dividing $24 million, and we're spending now coming up on half an hour, 45 minutes on $15,000, we could say, Parks Director, it's a noble idea. We're going to do a one-time pilot project to track the outcome. Do they spend this money on their fines? Do they get picked up by Chief Williamson's officers the next day with half a milligram or a milligram of methamphetamine in their pocket? But to go, let's try it. $15,000, not a whole lot of money in the scheme of things. Park and Rec, Mr. LaRue, administer it through his budget and just see where it goes.
But, one
final comment. For county council, do we have the ability to give away county dollars? And secondly, do they then become employees covered by workers' comp, covered by all the other issues that we have with employees?
Well, first, I don't think you're giving away the county dollars. You're giving away the
trust fund. You're giving away public money, and there is a crime for giving away public money, and I'm concerned with that.
Well, they are performing a service, so I think it's doable. We phrase it as a stipend. I think it's something that we can work on, that we can do, depending on whichever way that your committee decides to go. I think we can work that into the agreement.
And I don't think we're just giving it. We're working for that. So I don't think it's just giving it.
It's not a donation. We're not giving it to them freely. They're actually earning it in this particular case. Your other question was about the workers' comp. That's something I am working with our where this was coming up, so I am working with our insurance representative to find out if it's a workers' comp issue. I think that we would cover them on workers' comp, but I need to verify that.
And I'd like to make a comment regarding workers' comp. As I mentioned before, we use the work release program, community service, SIR, CalWORKS. The only program that we're responsible for using all of those folks is the work release program for workers' comp. All those other entities pick up the workers' comp cost.
Any other comments from Supervisor?
Thank you. As a follow-up to Mr. Moore's remark, I think what you are asserting is sound and reasonable, and I think the real incentive here to stay in a 15-week program is, at the end of the day, some freedom in getting access to a job. With that said, I believe strongly that the CBOs that do this should be involved in very closely helping folks make right decisions with the money, because for someone who has no money one day, so the next day has $1,500. For all of us who've been in this business, we know that can be a problem. But with that said, I do believe, I would agree with you, Mr. Moore, and indicate very strongly, though, for the success of this plan, that we work with these guys to establish a plan and to help them, really handle some of these, particularly child support payments, that you can then get the ball rolling on the license. That is such a critical piece of getting people employed. So, once again, I really applaud you, Bob, for coming in here.
And the other thing is, it's not they don't have money one day and have money the next. They're actually working 16 weeks, and during that 16 weeks, they're showing responsibility. I mean, they're showing that they can do this on a daily basis, and then they earn it. So I do not see an issue with this at all, because, I mean, they've worked for it, and they 16 weeks will show, that they're responsible during that time. But anyway, is that or any other comments, questions from the commission?
Wait, you'll get an opportunity to respond. Okay, right now, do we have a motion to move this board to the executive position?
So moved to approve this requested dollar amount and to move forward on the budget.
And where would the money go? To parks? To the parks?
You know, I don't know.
Can I just comment? I think it might be better if we don't decide. We have several factors, and we probably don't want to start allocating the money until we have heard all the proposals. We're not allocating it. We're just moving this forward to the executive committee to decide whether or not we want to do this or not. I think it's not a guarantee that he's going to get it, even though we're moving forward. So.
Motion to move it forward, correct?
Yes. I do have a motion, but I have a second. Second. Second from Dr. Waterman. All right. Is there anybody, members of the public, would like to comment on this?
I just have a quick comment. As a program that is for only women, I know that women would be very interested in something like that also, so I just want to make sure that I put that out there.
Wow, it was really cool. My name's Lynn Huckabee again, and I was listening to all the different perspectives, and I actually appreciate them. Thank you. And I know the population. I've been working in the field for 15 years now, and I just wanted to kind of give something for your think tank, and because I don't know if we're going to get many successes, because what I heard was maybe a model for down the road, and I'd like to get on that wagon sometime, you know. And so I just wanted to give you something to think about when we get into this discussion. And you might think about giving them their stipend in monthly increments. You might think about, say, $100 a week. Because the thing is I know the population, and they all have needs. Okay, they have children that need diapers. They have gas that needs to be paid for. And, of course, some of them smoke. Or most of them smoke, actually. And so do we want to get to this end? And so if I work a month at a time and I'm getting little allowances, okay, then I would more than likely, I would have more successes. That's what I'm thinking. If I wait 16 weeks, how many is going to finish that? Most of them are going to twist off and go to other areas where they're going to get paid weekly. You know, that's what I know or I believe. And so I just wanted to put that out there for you guys to think about and maybe chew on for a little bit. And that's all for me. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Okay.
Thank you. Clarification for Bob and Jen. This is for guys who are in the program physically living in New Life or in an outpatient program.
My understanding, and Jan can correct me if I'm wrong, these are people that are actually living there and they're signed up at DC for the work experience credit.
I wanted to put out there that if this is a motion that does pass and it comes to assembly block that causes some assembly more unable to do it, we'll have to bring it back before the committee. But at this point, I believe it's something we can work out in some fashion, contract-wise. But I did want to just put out there that it is a possibility that as we're going through the process, if we find out there is assembly block that prevents it, we'll have to come back before the committee.
Okay,
we
do have a motion to present it to the executive committee and a second. I think we need to do a roll call vote.
Could we have a clarification on what the motion is? The motion unrestricted 15 at the end, or it is
the motion that it, there is restriction on how the dollars can be used.
I think the motion is just for the executive committee to consider this program, and they can decide how, you know, it's just...
So all we're doing is saying, oh, executive, you guys figure it out.
Well, technically, that's the executive committee's job.
Well, may I ask for clarification then, or potentially a friendly amendment, is since we have the benefit of the full committee here, could, I think perhaps the motion might be a greater informational value to the executive committee if it were accompanied by a favorable recommendation. So the motion, for example, might be to forward it to the executive committee with a favorable recommendation, recognition for favorable consideration, and then we could have the benefit of the committee's membership in terms of how does, for example, Mr. Smith, the ECR, what is his view about it?
District Attorney Green?
No.
Public Defender Moore?
Yes.
Sheriff Youngblood?
No.
Dr. Waterman?
Yes.
Chief Williamson?
No.
Director Alvarez?
No.
Director Cheadle?
Yes.
Executive Director Corson?
I'll say yes.
Supervisor Perez?
Yes.
Director Smith?
Yes.
Superintendent Lizardi Frazier, absent. Division Director Merrill.
Yes. Okay. I believe the motion passes and it will be heard before the executive committee. And with that, let's take a quick 10-minute break before we go to get kicked out. Okay, we're going to reconvene the meeting. At this point, everybody's here except for Dr. Waterman, who's not back yet. However, we are going to continue. 9B, the community-based organization, I think we did most of that, but I'm going to give an opportunity for those who did not speak at that time. Okay. As well, 10-minute program, progress and options, and I believe Mr. Marable has a presentation to make first.
Yeah, actually, we'll, the three main departments that work with the CBO program, which is mental health, the sheriff information, we came up and have a recommendation, memorandum, regarding the CBO program. We're all going to kind of talk about it. I believe we'll leave it to them. The algorithm is going to start first, so I'll turn it over.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I was nominated. Well, so you can tell that it was not quite to speak to this issue. As most of you recall, the TPP did recognize the need to want to expand its plan to include community-based organizations. Prince County Mental Health took the lead in creating that request for application and convened an evaluation committee that was made up of representatives from all of your departments. And in the course of that evaluation committee, while there were 8 identified areas that people could submit applications for, that evaluation committee recommended that the highest priority for the expenditure for the CBO allocation were for housing. That, in fact, what people needed was stable, drug-free housing. And so, based on those recommendations of the evaluation committee, they recommended 7 contracts to you. And what was purchased was a total of, I believe it's 78 beds for Silver Libby and two contractors to deliver case management services. These were then probation contracts, and so we facilitated the process all the way to the execution of those contracts. These contracts began in January, so they are not even a full year into their contract. What we decided very early on was to create a process where we would determine that the Sheriff's Department would be the gatekeeper for those beds. And so even, for example, if probation wanted to make a referral for those beds, they actually went to the Sheriff's Department. Literally, our gatekeeper is Lieutenant Gonzalez. CBOs are required to submit claims for payment based on the name of the person that's occupying the bed, the number of bed days that are on that claim, which means then because we have a database that tells us exactly who we put in that bed, if they walked away, if they completed, etc., we had the ability to reconcile those claims for families. The other thing that we did with the case management program was to reimburse them at actual cost. So those were line item budgets that were included in the contract. Unfortunately, what we didn't include in the contract in the first year is the ability to do a line item shift from one to another. So that's why you're seeing Ms. Castile come to you and say, my hands are tied, I cannot move money from one line to the other. That can be rectified, and the recommendation is going to be to rectify the language on the contract. After coming together and creating, if you will, not only the claiming process, but the communication process, as well as the referral process all together, what I would say to you is that today what we have is a cohort of CBOs that come together on a monthly basis, have learned the terminology of AB 109. They have the ability to sit down with both probation and Sheriff's Department in a monthly meeting to communicate any kinds of policy issues related to blackout, to walkaways, to ankle monitors being cut off, etc. And so there's a very tight, cohesive group that comes together on a monthly basis, meets with the three engaged departments. We are able to review data. We created, if you will, the data tracker for Ms. Jameson to be able to report. Knowing that these contracts were for 1 year, we asked if we could go back and look at the data and come back with recommendations. And so what you have in front of you are a series of recommendations, and I will tell you, I only want to discuss the option that we think is the most viable, which is, number one, that you would maintain the capacity of the CBOs, and in fact would consider to be able to expand the current CBO organization. Each one of them has more beds available than what they are contracted for. We have a system in place that is that demands a high level of accountability. We have created, if you will, the proper procedures for who should be eligible to go into those beds. And so we really recommend that we have a good system in place. We are seeing high production, and we are seeing high completion rates.
What you will see with those walkaways and failures are really representative of the early days of when we thought you could make it, and we, after, hindsight said, what were we thinking? Why did you send Tangent out there? So a lot of those walkaways and failures you really seen coming in the first several months, the first quarter. I think that both probation and sheriff's departments would tell you those completion rates are much higher, much better than that early first quarter. So that's the recommendation that the work group wanted to bring to you.
I just kind of want to add to what Lily's saying about some of the data that was discussed earlier, and maybe clarify some stuff for the executive committee as they move to that motion. District Attorney Green was correct in the dollar amount. The data that you have in front of you is through September 30th. So there is $80,000 left, 48% of their money left for the UI. So the numbers you have, we did till the third quarter. Through 8:30 is Westcare. We didn't process their claim in time yet, so they're the only one that is left through August 30th. So the money allocations as we go forward are correct as what we have left. Overall, we spent 62% of that pot of money, of the initial money. The 82%, kind of want to explain it, in probation, mental health, and our department went round and round trying to figure out how do we show success, because we've had a lot of walkaways based on the bad crash we saw earlier. The walkaways that were occurring are within the first 1 or 2 or 3 days. So what we measured the success, the 82% that you're seeing in front of you, is completion, the people that actually stayed. And we're seeing the turnaround on those people. 82% of the people that are doing 30 days, 60 days, or 90 days, that's what we're measuring, not the ones that are walking away. So although it looks like we're having a lot of walkaways, we're actually having far more people stay in the program and complete it. Today's count, for example, 79. We have 74 beds. In order to spend some of the funds, we've allocated some extra beds on each of the homes to allow them to spend the funds. So we've been playing catch up the first 2 months. We didn't have hardly any of the beds filled. Last couple months, for example, we've given you like 24 beds versus the 20. So till the end of the year, we're doing that, keeping pretty close to us. Freedom House is right on track. All the other ones have some living room stuff. Most of the homes, the bed money will be spent. The occasional beds, probably not. So District Attorney Green was right. There's probably going to be some money left over. How much? I could probably give a guess based on what we've done monthly so far.
Just to go over a little bit more what Ms. Alvarez was saying about the recommendation, there's several ways that the DPT can go and how they want to do that. We can start from scratch and do a lot of RFA. We definitely don't recommend that. We think that the process that it is now is successful as far as what's being accomplished. We don't think it's the amount of work and effort to start all over that doesn't make sense to us. So that option number 5, which is on the last page of that, on page 4 of that memorandum. Basically, what we're recommending is that we keep the current CEOs, we increase the capacity for all their services, and we work that out. That another factor to consider is, even with the $1.2 million that we're taking off the top of the CEOs, or of the growth money, the CPO's program will still only be funded to about $780,000, around there. So that's short of the current, out this past year, we dedicated about $980,000. So we need $188,000 of growth money just to get back to a status quo level. And then if we went forward with the expansion of the services, which would allow for 68 more SLA beds and additional services for 9 defenders, that would be on top of that an additional $710,500. So In order to do that, for 1 year of the growth money, we'd be asking for $898,942. That, to us, logistically seems to make more sense to expand our services, to be able to show the state that we're seriously committed to the intent of what the growth money is for, and also with the smallest amount of disruption to services that it's actually received today. There's a couple other just quick points that I wanted to take out. The one is we've already mentioned, and that's the contract language. We were not able to do the line item changes, and we realized as we got in there that the CEOs, they're still trying to do what the intent is, but they realized if they had this type of person instead of this person, it would work better. We all felt that as long as we're getting the intent of what we want, that those CEOs should have that with the approval of the program, that they should be able to do that. But we would like to change the language of the contract, which is my understanding that typically most of the county contracts have that ability to do that. The other item that we would like the CCP to consider is, although we have growth money this year, there's no reason that we can't take the money and do it over multiple years. So if the CCP could say we wanted to do $800,000, but if we wanted to do it for 2 years, we would do 1.6. Whatever the amount the CCP wanted to do. But I think that shows a long-term commitment to these types of programs. So we would just throw that out there that the CCP also consider that as a 2-year contract, which is funding to guarantee. Because we don't know what our funding is going to be next year. It's possible that it's more, it's possible it's the same. But this way, at least for the foreseeable future, we could guarantee this program. Is there anything else?
So what you're actually suggesting is that we fund just a little bit of makeup money in a sense going in, and the funding for this comes here, and you're suggesting that we set aside money out of the excess we have at this point for the following year also.
That's correct.
So that would be about $1 million, almost $2 million.
If we're asking for just under $900,000 with the expansion, so it'd be 1.8 if you wanted to do it for 2 years.
So how did you determine what you would be funding CBOs at in terms of their total capacity? Did you choose to bring some of them to 75% capacity, some to 100%? Because I know different CBOs are at different places in terms of their bed space.
I reached out to all the CBOs, asked them what, if there were to be extra funds, how much more beds they can add. So we took all the information the CBOs provided us, and we came up with that 66. So some homes had 3 beds, some had 9, some had 14, some had 21 more beds.
I see. Did you take all the available beds?
Everything they suggested. So if we asked them, if I were to give you extra money, how many more beds do you have available for the CCP? And they gave me a number.
And you took all of their suggestions?
Yes. That's where the 66 and the 988 comes from.
I see. Thank you. Was there a consideration for any other organizations or CBOs that were not funded the first year? How did that look? What's coming down the pipe?
Yeah, there were certainly discussions, and the CCP certainly worked through that. We kind of looked at it from a logistical point of view, because if you now open it up to additional, you have to go off out to RFA again. There's mental health did a lot of work on it last time. And the amount of resources that it takes when we already have something that's pretty new, seems certainly successful, but we kind of want to stick with what we got. It just made the most sense for us specifically with the amount of disruption that process takes. But that's why we're recommending it.
What is your sense really about how many other CBOs there are in the community that have dead space availability but need some help with moving along the process?
I just have to say, first of all, let me just qualify what I'm going to say. I was never part of the evaluation committee. I did not read those proposals, so I cannot tell you specifically what was there. All I can do is to tell you that there are summaries and scores, and these particular programs certainly rose to the top because of their scores. So whether or not you'd be looking at, I'm sure there are other facilities out there, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they would be providing you any kind of quality of service. So
I would just say to you that the list that I saw with all the applications identified these as the strongest applications.
But that was because our primary goal was housing. So there were many other strong applications, many, many others, but housing wasn't there. Primary, because we had people come in later and speak to this group about why they didn't get funding and how they understand the process. So I think there were many other strong groups that weren't funded because that our organization decided as a group that we were going to look at the housing as our primary goal in our first foray. And I didn't have any understanding at the time that was going to be limited. In subsequent years, we were limited to the number of organizations or only some of the organizations. And it seems to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong about the law, but wouldn't the process, if you had to do the RFA again, I mean, now that you've gone through it once, wouldn't it be a little bit easier now that you've kind of been through it? Or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, Michael, 100% down to 90% of the work. But not from 100% down to 25% of the work.
And let me also clarify that when you published the RFA, you identified eight areas that you were willing to fund. It is your evaluation committee that identifies housing as its most pressing issue. So, that's why the recommendation came back to you. We went through the RFA, we got this money, and here's our priority, and therefore those are. And again, I will say that even against those other proposals, these were the strongest anyway.
I don't know.
Supervisor.
I have a question. Just agreeing. Is it your memory that all of the folks that had some housing capacity, we funded them so long as they were eligible in the other area. So were there folks that could potentially house as well? Should they just be brought up a few notches or some assistance to be qualified, to be, you know, to have all those processes in place? I think there were some that just didn't get any money because we had a limited fund. That's my recollection. We only had a little less than $1 million. So there were some that had housing components that are I think there were others that didn't realize they didn't really get it. There are patients that had a stronger housing component because they did that have a part of our program. So everybody's kind of looking up the team.
But, as a follow-up to Mr. Green's remarks, it seems to me that we should be exploring the other organizations that are in place. Because I can't imagine COVID itself that 56 says even scratches the surface for the needs that you have. And that's, of course, a ton of work and a ton of money as it is that 56 beds represent. But if there are folks out there that have some capacity to house, and it sounds like there are, that we should be considering them because as we evolve and expand, we need more of these groups to be up and running and kind of speed, would seem to me.
And my recollection is that, I wasn't sitting in the room, but it's my recollection of the application that the majority of the proposals for housing were selected with the exception of a couple of housing programs. One of them wasn't even in our county. So I think that, but I wasn't in the room.
I was going to say, there's certainly a lot of CEOs out there that do a lot of great things that didn't get money. And there's no doubt about that. And I've heard from a lot of them. To me, the vet from probation, the sheriff, and mental health as well, that the vetting is such a need, and it serves multiple purposes. But one thing, it helps the sheriff with their jail population, because you know, they're able to release them on a monitor in a controlled setting. And so that opens up vetting for people who in jail who are on long-term projects. Or as the Sheriff's Department mentioned earlier, they can use it as an incentive to make sure they do these programs because now they have the capability of holding somebody longer or shorter for the project. So to increase the vetting for probation, it's just a benefit when we get somebody come straight out of prison with no place to go. You know, and in the past, they were trying to be on their own. We kind of get a homeless shelter that, you know, typically does not work. But that gives us, you know, a great service that gets the person into a controlled environment so we can grab them out. If we're going to increase, if the CCP thinks we should increase residential capacity or SLA capacity, logistically, the simplest is we already have these homes already in existence. If we want to go above the 68, and then I can see, well, okay, let's introduce other things, but why would we start from zero when all we have to do is just a little turn key, and just right away, January 1st, we increase capacity by 68. So that was the logistical kind of practicality that this department had in mind.
Yeah. In all of this, let me add something to that. All of this was decided in our last ongoing budget as to which, you know, CBOs were going to get funding. But remember, this money that we're talking about today is one-time money. We don't know if it's going to continue. We don't know if we're going to have growth for next year. The projection for next year, as I indicated, is down a little bit. However, if we get a larger percentage and our amount increases, then I think, yeah, we should consider other things, expanding our services to other groups. But I don't know if it would be prudent to fund a new program now out of this money, knowing that it's only one time money. This may not be the best time to do it.
So this impresses me as a shining example of the private-public partnership. I'd like to express my appreciation and credit for the work of Lieutenant Gonzalez and the Sheriff's Department and your efforts in integrating the delivery of services. Director Alvarez in identifying the challenges and concerns in the strict line item allocations, and Mr. Miracle and probation for their thorough and thoughtful review of potential options and the insightful recommendations, as well as Dr. Waterman in terms of identifying the benefits of promoting stability, recognizing Chief Cooley does that it's one-time money. So I know we all are looking forward to working well for the afternoon on this, but if there's any nature, perhaps we could entertain a motion to approve the 898 and then either one or two additional years of funding together with authorization to the probation department to amend or permit line item transfers to improve flexibility to the administrators of the money. So I'm hopeful that we can just sort of these back and then
is that a motion?
Or
one
of
the afternoon real quick.
just real quick. So this is one-time money. We're giving to the same organization that we funded before to expand their operations, yes? When we come to the budget year with our expected annual money, I think you said that then we'll get the opportunity for other RFA. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, if the money is there, there's an increase of money. Because there's no guarantee that we're going to get the same amount.
I understand that. So there's potential that we could eliminate funding CBOs, is that what we're saying? To continue the operations, mental health, and probation, and the other organizations that we're funding. And I know I don't need an answer for that right now. I'm thinking out loud as we move down this 2-year plan that it sounds like we're getting ready to embark on. So in 2 years, we're funding these people for 2 years, but when we come back to the budget and ask for expansion, are the CBOs that we're funding initially right now going to get additional funding on top of this funding as well? Or are we considering the new funding from the budget year for new CBO organizations to expand what we're doing that don't have the opportunity to join into an RFA process right now? You guys follow me, Lily?
Yeah. So let me comment. When we published the RFA, basically said, this is a pilot, we know for sure we could fund you for a year, if possible, up to 3.
Okay, I recall that.
So we are already, we're finishing up year 1.
Okay.
If this committee says, not only do we commit for year 2,
and we want to reserve for year three, you naturally now come up to, you have to go out to RFA again anyway.
Not knowing whether there was a motion on the table.
Was it for 1 year or 2 years?
I was thinking to either 2 or 3 just to promote stability and get an insurance future year planning and benefits. Based on adjustments to those who thought about the strictly relationship and the grant commercial.
So if you would. You would agree to 2 years, that keeps us through our 3 year cycle, which was suggested at the beginning, or makes sense in the RFA process.
2 additional years, is that what your motion?
Whatever is going to happen.
That's the motion.
Okay, couple of minutes. Is that a motion?
Yes.
Talk about second.
Okay, second by Dr. Waters. Any?
Yes.
I'm not understanding, we're supposed to take minus the money that we need, so let's 8 million, it's not 8 million, isn't it? Minus 1.2 to supplement the shortfall for last year's budget, that way. Okay, so it's the 8 million, round it off. No one else wants any of that money, is that right?
Okay.
No, that's
how? Yeah, we're not going to get those.
Well, I mean, how are we making decisions with it until we...
This is just a recommendation to send it to the executive committee on that. We can, the executive committee really is the committee that makes the determination where the money goes. And if we at that point decide not to do it, then we don't do it.
So then letting the committee with modify the state, make it safe, recognition favorable consideration made on the recommendation of the Premier for the Education Department and the phenomenon with Kennedy Dolphin and the Sheriff's Department in promoting such strong outcomes and alternative treatment situation.
With that amendment to that motion, I'm going to go with that second. Any other comments by the committee? Okay, any comments from the public? I see none. Then we do need a roll call vote.
Excuse me?
Yes.
Chief Court Investigative Officer McNally is absent. District Attorney Green?
Yes.
Public Defender Moore?
Yes.
Sheriff Gambler?
Yes.
Dr. Waterman?
Yep.
Chief Williamson?
Yes.
Director Alvarez?
Yes.
Director Cheadle?
Yes.
Executive Director Corson?
Yes.
Supervisor Perez?
Yes.
Director Smith?
Yes.
Superintendent Lizardi Frazier is absent. Division Director Miracle?
Yes. Okay. The motion will be presented to the executive. 9D, additional consideration for additional funding request from the DC members. And again, what else people do is start with what we did the last time, started with the highest to go down the floor. So,
I would suggest that we're only going to go to noon. If we don't do one or two and then come back 10 weeks later, have to start over again.
You want to adjourn? Like to adjourn
you
now?
You have to be on noon, yes.
Yes, I have to go down the floor. So is that a motion to adjourn now and to set another meeting for the meeting?
Yes.
Okay, so I have a second to that motion. So we can hear all the proposals in one day, which makes a lot of sense.
Is there some way that we could see everybody's proposals prior to the meeting so I won't have to hear it and then...
I think we can. So if we adjourn, what happens to the executive committee? That will all continue. We will pick up where we left off, 9C, and then we will finish the rest of the agenda. Director Albert.
Chief Cougay, could we also ask for the John Nylon show? I thought it was really helpful to see the numbers and to see different proposals
and to be able to see what the consequence would be if you went one way or another. But we could all see together. He had his Excel, he had projections, and we were all able to participate in that process. And I really appreciated that. That would be a
record.
Okay.
You know, maybe I just want to hear about it.
Do I need to clear the table?
Okay, we do have a motion to adjourn today's meeting.
I would be pleased to do that, but if that's you're willing to do it.
Well,
Yeah,
we will need it probably within the next couple of weeks. So by that, everybody has their proposal distributed to everybody else.
If I can make a friendly note that if everyone, whatever date we pick, that we pick a day, several days before, and everyone in individual departments can submit their proposal next week, and next can distribute them to everybody, would that be successful to do that?
All right, with that, certainly amendment to second still fit. So who is second? Nobody second. Would you accept that amendment?
Yes.
Okay. And do I have a second?
Second.
Second by Director Forster. Okay, all in favor? Aye. All opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, now we need to set the next date. We have 1-2 weeks. We've got November 6th. Does that work for everybody? That's the first Wednesday of November. We're going to see her next week for either the 30th or the 6th. Yeah. Is the 6th okay with everybody else?
The 30th is more than 30th. Oh, I'm sorry, no.
I'll bring up the speed of proxy. We're allowed to do that.
Yeah.
I'll have Brad Cloud here. Right.
Okay. Then we will cancel the meeting for 8:30 on Wednesday, November 6th.